So I actually am a lawyer and am trained to think about rights. And so, frankly, it's so exciting to be at a place where lawyers usually are not and see non-lawyers using legal frameworks to think about things, because usually it's the opposite. That is, law is a very reactive discipline, taking what other people do. So I found those just terrifically interesting. And there's also a kind of environmental and social justice theme, which, Yvonne, you deserve credit for, because without knowing me, certainly, you managed to bring people who are actually talking about very similar things. So thank you very much. My talk is called Our Bandit Future, and this is the continuation of a project that I started several years ago. I also, like Jennifer, work a lot in Latin America, and Brazil is one of the places I work. And in 2005, it was an especially hot summer in Brazil, and I was working at the time in Rio de Janeiro, and Rio was a much more dangerous city then than it is now, although it's not a walk in the park now, but it was even more dangerous then. And there was a very high incidence of very violent crime that hot summer. And I was in a cab one day, and the cab driver, and cab drivers are, of course, an interesting part of any society because they see all parts of it, right? They see the rich parts, they see the poor parts. They really, in my experience, are good guides to the kind of basic demographics of any place. And this cab driver, the Rio cab drivers in particular, tend to be very chatty. They're famously so. And he was positing that the heat actually was exacerbating the violence. And then he added that he thought that with climate change that these problems were going to get worse, and that, in his words, we were facing our bandit future. And I actually said to him, you know, there's a good article in that, and if I write it, I'm going to use that as the title, and I ended up doing that, looking at climate change governance, because, in fact, out of the University of Toronto, some of you may know the literature of Thomas Homer Dixon, the social scientist, and his group, and they have drawn very, very powerful correlations between, in different contexts all over the world, between increased physical violence and heat. And so that was kind of my starting off point. But where it took me as a lawyer was really to think about what that means for coming up with a response and who are going to be the winners and losers in climate change debate. So not unlike Jennifer, I started thinking about heat-related problems, but it took me a different direction, and that's where I'm going to go today. And so my concern increasingly as I thought about this and as I reviewed that literature is about what for me is the central demographic fact and challenge of our age, and that is urbanization. That is, we are now a majority urban planet, and that seems only to grow. And it's important, I think, just quickly to recall what exactly that urbanization is like. That is, and the 2050 numbers are actually conservative. The United Nations, within its big rambling system, actually has contradictory data. Sometimes the estimates by 2030 are as high as 80% of the world's population to be urban. But conservatively, and all of these come from various UN agencies, we're almost to 66% urban by 2050. And what's striking about this, of course, is that this is a phenomenon that is now true on every continent in the world, right? I actually turned 56 years old yesterday. I'm very typical of people in my generation that all of my parents were, grandparents, excuse me, were born on farms in rural communities. All of my grandparents died in cities. That's now a global phenomenon. It's even true in the least urbanized historically parts of the world, that is Sub-Saharan Africa and Southeast Asia. Latin America has actually been more urbanized more densely than any other region in the world longer. But in Sub-Saharan Africa and in Southeast Asia, now that is also true, this urbanization. And we're getting people concentrated in megacities. You can see the figures there that speak to this threefold threefold growth in a very short historical period. And it's also important to note that in small and medium-sized cities, there is also very fast growth. Now, it's important to remember for my purposes, and I will get to climate change, back to climate change governance in just a second, but for these purposes, given this fact of urbanization, it's very important to think about and to recall how people live. And I know there are other people here who work in the so-called developing world, a phrase I hate, but that's a discussion for another time. But in the so-called developing world, or at least the economic developing world, it's important to remember how they live, because it's very far from even the reality of many poor people in the United States. This is a picture of Belo Horizonte, which is the third largest city in Brazil. It's a big industrial, it's kind of the Chicago of Brazil. It's a big industrial city in the interior of Minas Gerais state. And most of the people live like the people on the lower right-hand quadrant of that photograph. That is in disorganized, hastily built construction with no clear provision of infrastructure. And importantly, for climate change purposes, often in hillsides or in coastal areas that are the areas most at risk of severe weather events related to and triggered by climate change. That is, they don't live like the more privileged in the upper left quadrant of the photo above you in an ordered and well-planned city. But I deliberately start with this photo because, of course, it demonstrates very powerfully the need for those of us who live like more like the folks in the upper left-hand part of the quadrant than the lower right, because they are deeply intertwined at the end of the day when we face these challenges. And what I want to stress with these pictures is whether hillside or riverbed or floodplain, the similarities, that is, the threats to human and environmental health, which are evident here with the water gathering, whether that's from open water, running water source, or whether it is sewage and discarded gray and black water, the public health threats from the trash here, and the lack of fundamental infrastructure, which nonetheless this girl in Lagos is able to overcome. She appears to be very happy, apparently, on her way to school. And again, I want to stress the similarities in these conditions for what is the world's majority now. Not us, but the world's majority. So I'm picking them on all continents. Once again, this is the Jocinha slum in Rio, said to be the largest in Latin America, estimated between 100 and 300,000 people, and those estimates are unreliable. And I should also stress here the proximity to important natural assets like the Atlantic rainforest, which is in the upper part of that photograph. Jakarta, again, I'm just trying to take a tour around the globe to illustrate that despite that there are differences in slum conditions in different countries, there is a great degree of commonality. This, I think, is the most poignant of all of the pictures I've chosen, because if you can see there, the resolution isn't very good, but that building through which the water runs in the middle is the New Faith Ministry primary school. And so really very powerfully illustrates the concern I think we all need to have about the environmental and public health threats. So in sum, what do all of these habitations, now the majority of the world's population is living in, what do they have in common? Precarious construction, very dense living conditions for the public health professionals. You'll know, for example, that that helps contribute, for example, to the rise of, as we're seeing, TB in epidemic proportions in places like Mumbai and Rio de Janeiro, for that matter, because there is density in very small, dark spaces that allows tuberculosis to thrive. So great risk of accident, loss of life, environmental and natural resource threats, the kind of heat threats that Jennifer was talking about, but in an urban environment with then more probability of disease transmission. And once again, these people, the world's majority, are living in places most at risk of climate change, whether that is low-lying coastal areas or hillsides for a variety of facts, for a variety of reasons. So, to quote the famous English philosopher Thomas Hobbes, their lives are nasty, brutish, and short, and that demands that we think about what to do. Now, one of the things that is also very true, I imagine very much like the population you were describing, is that these people are largely uninformed about what we would call their rights, And they are also excluded from the ability to have any control or any agency over their conditions or their life circumstances. And they're uninformed about the consequences. Now, I don't fool myself for a minute that if you went and talked to people in any of these communities or a sugarcane cutting community in Costa Rica, that if you talked to them about climate change, that that would be high on their agenda of problems, because they are facing many more urgent daily needs. But I think it's important that we can begin to think about providing ways for people to have more dignified, healthier lives by addressing what are effectively and ultimately climate change problems by thinking of ways of incorporating the public in decisions about the conditions in which they live their lives. And so in my remaining 10 minutes, what I'll do is talk about how we might give communities greater voice with control over their lives that I think incidentally will have the effect of addressing some of the gravest concerns we have about adaptation to climate change. Adaptation is, that is to say, that we accept that climate change is a phenomenon which is dramatically changing our lives, and we have to make changes in our conditions to respond to the consequences of that. Now, I think this is particularly urgent because in the, in my view, largely failed conference of parties discussions that have that occur now every 2 years as part of the UN overseeing climate change negotiations. In the last conference of parties in Copenhagen and Cancun, Mexico, one of the things that's emphasized again and again is the importance to give voice, to give participation to citizens, but there's really no discussion of how that should happen or what the structure of that should be. So that's my project, is to try to think about, okay, the Conference of Parties says let's give greater voice to communities, to people in the world's majority. How exactly do we do that? And so what I want to propose is a normative scheme to incorporate the voice of people at the grassroots level, and to do so in four stops, for four reasons. And so the first of those is, and these are rather obvious, but that doesn't mean that they aren't worth stating, that is to draw upon local land use knowledge to come up with solutions for the way land should be managed. Second, to make problems like neighborhoods, whether low-lying areas or hillsides, both good examples, at high risk of flooding because of climate-related events, to make them part of the solution by giving people ownership over the situation. In the process, then, third, to enhance the awareness of climate change and raise the level of focus. And then finally, to use local communities as laboratories to come up with solutions, because as I've been implying, I don't think that the international global climate change adaptation discussions have been particularly effective. So the harder question there is, how exactly do we do this? As I said, I acknowledge that poor people who are the world's majority, the first thing on their mind is not how do we adapt to climate change. The first thing on their mind is, how do I keep a roof over my head, how do I drink clean water, and so on. But I'm trying to suggest that at a very deep level, these are actually profoundly related situations, and that justifies giving people greater voice. Why are they profoundly related? Because they're interested in preserving the security of their homes, of the sanitation of their homes, and of having sound infrastructure, and those are things that are all implicated by climate events. So what I want to look at then is to look at some models, and there are available models for robust public participation in the context of a complicated issue like climate change adaptation. And there are a number of public participation models which I'd suggest can be normalized, even accounting for differences in culture and geography. Think, for example, of the coastal management stakeholder fora that they have in Oregon, for example, or in Maine, right? We have those examples in the United States. They're reasonably successful at providing a mechanism for people people to air views and share them. There are also non-political management solutions that have been developed to transfer priorities for decision-making about how to take public action from, again, non-political actors to political and governmental actors. I'm thinking particularly of the famous participatory budgeting models that have been developed starting in the 1980s in southern Brazil and that have been copied all over Latin America, in parts of Southeast Asia, in parts of sub-Saharan Africa, and even in cities that are suburbs to Montreal and Paris, so I'm saying in the more economically developing world as well. But there are such models that work very effectively to bubble up ideas and then transfer them over so that the relevant authorities drill them down. And finally then, a good example would be the celebrated Rwandan examples in sub-Saharan Africa. Rwanda is, of course, like Burundi, a particularly interesting example and studied in the literature of things like social participation because, unlike most of the post-colonial countries in sub-Saharan Africa, those kingdoms existed more or less intact before the colonial period. So they're actually very much like their pre-colonial form. And so they've carried on traditions that were developed before colonial rule. And so the Rwandan Ubadehe is well celebrated in the literature, community-based local needs assessment practice. And so what I'm trying to suggest by these, a U.S. example, an example developed in Brazil and copied the world over, and the Rwandan example, is that we have existing models for community-based local decision-making that is not, in the first instance, controlled by governmental actors that is used to provide forums to have voice. Now, what are the difficulties, just to conclude, what are the difficulties, Wyvon, I have what, like 3 minutes? Two?
You have,
one? 3 minutes and 40 seconds. Okay, I can do this. So what are the criticisms of these processes? Well, the literature pretty consistently identifies at least three concerns about any such process, whether it's the Rwandan, whether it's the Brazilian participatory budgeting model, whether it's something like the coastal management stakeholder forum. So again, dealing with different problems in each of those three traditions, it's interesting to note the criticisms that appear again and again in the literature. And as I suggest, they're primarily, in my view, three. First, there's a worry that short-term thinking will dominate the decisions. And in the climate change context, that, of course, is particularly undesirable. And as I'm suggesting, the kind of forum that could be normalized and routinized everywhere across the globe should focus on land use questions, really as the proxy, if you like, for dealing with, and land management questions, as the proxy for addressing questions of climate change. So that short-term thinking is a concern, without question. There's also a concern about institutional capture, that is, that to say that if you come to people and say, well, we want you to come up with better land use management techniques, or you say to them, we want you to formulate a climate change adaptation strategy, that compels certain institutional choices, that there is not real deep democracy at work, and also a fair enough critique. And finally, there's a technocratic concern. It's a rather paternalistic one, but it's a common one, and that is to say that lay knowledge doesn't always appreciate the scientific concerns, the implications of action. So what's a possible way out of the woods then, and truly in my conclusion. And my way out of the woods here is to draw upon these public participation models, but to do the following. That is, not to predetermine. Say, we want you to come up with land use decisions that will improve the physical and environmental health of you and your communities. Right, to make it a very broad and open-ended. Second, to set timelines that are deliberately free of short-time horizons, that is, to make people understand that they're thinking about the next generation or two. And finally, to make the task one that identifies strategic priorities for adaptation rather than committing to particular decisions. That is, to limit, say, and in these land management decisions, you have to focus on the two things that are most going to address concerns about the physical and environmental health of you and the people in your community. And in this way, I'd suggest that this would be a way to develop community-based models that feed up ideas and suggestions so that they then can be transferred down. And finally, I should say that in this kind of context, and this is perhaps the most controversial part of what I'm suggesting, I would, in designing this or in my proposals, I'm actually, rather than working against traditional community divisions, which is something we tend to do in the United States, we tend to say, let's be inclusive, let's get everyone a seat at the same table. I would say, no, let's have different tables. Let's let people who identify with a particular ethnic or racial or gender group work together to identify their concerns apart from that larger majority, because in my view, much harm has been done by trying to insist that everybody sits at the same table, because power imbalances tend to affect the result at the end of the day. The risk of not doing this is that we're going to be imposing solutions, and again, the Conference of the Parties at the UN climate change talks reflects this to me, that we're going to be imposing solutions that don't respond to and recognize local realities and therefore won't be adapted and will not have the buy-in or participation of affected communities. So again, I'm trying to celebrate local knowledge and provide a structural mechanism to do that. So thank you very much.